Welcome to the Supreme Court of Virginia podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Ben Glass Law and Virginia appellate attorney Steve Emmert. Listening to oral arguments from the Supreme Court of Virginia is one of the best ways to stay abreast of both substantive and procedural law. And today's smart lawyers know that any case, even if it is outside their practice area, can offer a learning opportunity. So, listen, enjoy, subscribe, and leave us feedback.
Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Peter Kamakaiva-Ole on behalf of Kirk and Kristen Sosby. With your permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you. This case turns on who has the power to make Virginia's homeschool law. Is it the General Assembly alone, or can its statute be recast by 133 local school boards in accordance with their own local lights? The case for the General Assembly is straightforward. It's the legislature. And as the legislature, it has told parents in 22-1-254-1B what they must include in their notice of intent. And it has unambiguously divided those disclosures into two categories: things that require mere notice and things that must be proven with evidence. Parents need only give notice of their intent to homeschool and the list of subjects they will teach. They only need provide evidence that they fit one of the four criteria in subsection A. And if parents do those things, their homeschool is lawful. The case for the board is far more difficult to pin down, relying on isolated phrases and statutes, some of which do not even apply to homeschooling on their face, or speculative concerns about resources or the untrustworthiness of parents. However the board slices it, its theories can't escape this fatal defect. It wants the power to prosecute families like Sosby's who refuse to provide more evidence than is required by the statute, even in cases like this where it concedes it has all the evidence required by the law and no reason to think the Sosby's are lying. The circuit court saw nothing wrong with that. We urge this court, instead of affirming that decision, to reaffirm its holdings in cases like Camp against Burchett and Lee County against Town of St. Charles. Local boards cannot arrogate the power to change the General Assembly statutes or punish the law-abiding as lawbreakers. The board's policy does just that by legislating additional burdens onto homeschooling parents that it intends to enforce through criminal prosecution. This court has repeatedly recognized since Hancock against Stevens that it's not novel for agencies and even courts on occasion to amend statutes by adding requirements to them, but in all cases that still arrogates lawmaking power from the General Assembly. The board's position is essentially the same one rejected by this court in its 2002 decision, Lee County against Town of St. Charles. There, a sewer board was established pursuant to a statute that said the board had to include at least one member from each affected town, but did not require all members of the board to be residents of affected towns. The board's makeup met that statutory requirement, but there was an additional board member who was not a resident. And the board decided that they wanted to add a residency requirement for all of its members. Now, this court in its unanimous decision thought that requirement, that policy as a principle of policy was eminently reasonable, but it still struck it down because the wrong body had made that policy judgment. The statute was ambiguous about the requirement to sit on the board, and the board's new policy requirements, the residency requirements, went beyond what the statute unambiguously said. Key to this court's holding was the fact that the General Assembly clearly knew how to write statutes that imposed these sorts of residency requirements that the sewer board was trying to adopt. In fact, the court noted that when it had intended to do so, it had done so explicitly in many other contexts. The board has essentially done the same thing here, adding new requirements to the homeschooling statute. The best evidence of this, if you turn to page 42 of the appendix, which is the board's policy, and you look at the subsection titled Notification by Parent, and then you remove the language that the Sosby's are challenging, the second to last sentence. What remains, if you were to read it, is almost a verbatim reprint of subsection B of the statute. And what the policy has done, quite literally, is add language to the statute's language. New evidence required by parents that the General Assembly hasn't approved. That, we submit, is the quintessential example of amending a statute by local decree, and no different from what the sewer board tried to do in Lee County. Again, as in Lee County, this is a situation, as we've argued extensively in our briefs, where the General Assembly not only knows how to write statutes that require evidence from parents and require parents to provide the specific proofs that the board wants to impose, proof of residency, birth certificates, the homeschool statute itself also includes specific explicit provisions that tell parents when evidence is required. I've already mentioned one. For the notice of intent, the only evidence required by the statute, and the statute is quite explicit about this, is the evidence that the parents meet one of the four criteria listed in subsection A. There's a second provision that occurs later in the statute covering the end of the year, and parents are required again explicitly to provide evidence of academic progress. The statute is also very explicit when it wants to give school officials authority to supervise homeschool programs. The most obvious example of this, of course, is the probation provision that occurs again later on in the statute. The board sits essentially, again, in the same defective position as the sewer board did in Lee County. It has changed the rules, and none of its proper justifications authorize that. The board essentially offers two competing statutory theories for its power to impose these new burdens on homeschooling families. The first of which is based on the language of the homeschool statute, but it's not a specific provision in the statute. It's a reference to phrases that appear in the statute. The statute talks about compulsory attendance aides. It talks about the division superintendent. The board is essentially treating these phrases as stalking horses. They can be used to unearth new power that's not explicitly granted in the statute. And the problem with this is sort of twofold. One, this court has repeatedly held that boards, like the school board, don't have the ability to create inherent power. They rely on either an explicit grant of power from the General Assembly or some grant of power that is necessarily implied from something that the General Assembly has authorized them to do. The age and compulsory attendance requirements that the board points to do not fall into either category. Again, the statute on its face is very explicit about the evidence parents have to require. These two things that the board are demanding are not included in the statute. And furthermore, the board's arguments are essentially policy judgments. They are concerned generally about parents misrepresenting information. They are concerned generally about parents maybe not living in the district. The problem with that argument, I just want to make sure that it's very clear. The Stosbys, as we mentioned in our brief, have no objection to school officials being able to inquire into parents, ask parents if they have reason to think that the information parents have provided is false. But that is not because of anything in the homeschool statute. That's because there are other surrounding statutes in that cluster, enforcement statutes that appear towards the end that make it, among other things, a crime, a Class 4 misdemeanor for parents to falsely represent the age of the child or their residency in a district. Nothing in the homeschool statute gives the board authority to require prophylactically of every single parent as a condition of homeschooling that they verify their child's age and that they reside in the district. Again, Lee County is very instructive on this point. The statute that the sewer board relied on there clearly talked about residency. It clearly used the correct phrases. And yet this court held very clearly that that didn't give the sewer board additional power to interpret those phrases and come up with policy restrictions and requirements that went beyond those enacted by the General Assembly.
Thank you for tuning in to the Supreme Court of Virginia podcast. My name is Ben Glass, and Steve Emmert and I provide these oral argument audios for free as a public service. If you're a fan of the podcast, I'd love to send you my book, Renegade Lawyer Marketing, absolutely free. Just visit www.benglassreferrals.com and I'll be glad to ship it to you. This book has helped thousands of lawyers across the country improve their lives and their practices. Again, that's benglassreferrals.com. Thank you for listening and enjoy these oral arguments from the Supreme Court of Virginia.
The board's argument about Code Section 22-178 suffers from essentially the same defect. That statute, as written, grants the board very limited power to regulate its own schools and its own internal affairs, consistent with state law. It does not confer any power to regulate homeschoolers, much less a broad power to demand new evidence that contradicts the promise of the statute that when the requirements in the statute are satisfied, the homeschool is lawful. This is not a policy related to board governance. It is clearly not a policy that supervises the division's own schools. And it is not a policy for the management of the board's affairs. We know that because that's not how the board treated the policy. When this matter began, the Sotheby's pointed out to the board that they had submitted a notice of intent before the policy changes went into effect. And the board decided not to apply the policy to the Sotheby's at that time. In other words, it concluded it could not apply the policy retroactively. That decision doesn't make any sense if the policy is meant only to govern the board's own conduct, if it's some sort of an interpretive rule that the board is going to apply, if it's some sort of internal directive for its own officers. The concerns about retroactivity only make sense if the board views the policy the same way that the Sotheby's do, that it is regulating the affairs of others, legislating new burdens onto parents that would be fundamentally unfair without some sort of prior notice. The last point that I'll make in the time that I have, and then if there are no additional questions, I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal, is that the board's argument, treating these isolated phrases as pockets of authority that can be tapped into, creates, as I've mentioned, essentially stalking horses within the statutes. Creative boards would be able, if not incentivized, to find others. And there's lots of low-hanging fruit if that's the position, if that's the reading of the statute. The statute talks about curriculum. It talks about the evidence of progress. It talks about the home. It even talks about the notice. And nothing in, if the statute is not king, if the statute does not carve out a zone of authority into which school boards cannot trespass, and if Franklin County can tap into that zone of authority, create some for itself, that opens up the risk that any other school board would be able to do the same. Requirements could vary from town to town, maybe even on the side of the street that you live on, depending how divisions are drawn. There's a possibility, as we argue in our brief, of 133 statutes effectively instead of just the one. And that's the furthest thing from what the General Assembly actually did, crafting a cohesive, consistent policy for the entirety of the Commonwealth.
You are into your rebuttal time, but you may use your time as you like.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. If there are no questions, I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right, 2 minutes, 45 seconds.
Thank you.
Mr. Matty, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Stephen Matty, and I represent the Pelley Franklin County School Board. I would submit to the court that policy LBD is consistent with Virginia Code 22.1254.1. The plain meaning, or actually the code plainly states in the beginning of the code section there, any parent of any child who will have reached the fifth birthday on or before September 30th of any school year and who has not passed the 18th birthday may elect to provide home instruction in lieu of school attendance. And the policy was created to verify that requirement that was outlined in the statute. And then the code plainly states, any parent who elects to provide home instruction shall annually notify the division superintendent by that August date. It doesn't say a superintendent. It doesn't say the superintendent in Fairfax or the superintendent of the state. It says the division superintendent where these homeschoolers reside. Franklin County's policy is within the legislator's intent and literal interpretation, whereby Virginia Code 221.254.1c outlines items that homeschoolers must provide to the division superintendent. Paragraph C further outlines requirements the division superintendent must take if none of those parental requirements are met, such as the proof of the child's progress. And if the homeschool program is placed on probation, remediation plans are to be filed with the division superintendent. School boards have to make testing and examinations available to students receiving home instruction, and they shall create a policy for when those students have to register for the exams, shall notify the home instruction students of registration deadlines, and they shall notify the family of any financial assistance, if applicable, and that's pursuant to paragraph F of 221.254.1.
Counsel, Justice Kelsey, if I may interrupt you with a question.
Yes,
I question whether the specificity that you're talking about in the notice provisions helps your case, because if they put that much effort into requiring very specific information notices and they did not require the specific notices that you've added with your policy, doesn't that suggest that there is no authorization for it, and that if they intended to give that authorization, they had to simply put it in the list themselves?
Well, Your Honor, that's a good question. I would submit that it supports my argument in the fact that it becomes business of the school board under 22.178, where that code section says a school board may adopt bylaws, regulations not inconsistent with state statutes and regulations of the Board of Education for its own government and for the management of its official business. And I think by outlining these specific things that or mandating these specific things to a school board, this becomes the board's business. And
so the board's
business
is to do anything on any topic related to homeschooling. That's the board's business, and so they can add to this list. Arguably, they could take from it.
No, Judge, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the General Assembly has mandated that we do these things in this particular code section. We have to provide them with the dates for the examinations. We have to provide them with registration deadlines. We have to provide them with any financial assistance if that's possible. We have to monitor a probationary period if they're not meeting proof of progress standards through their home instruction. Those are all mandated. So that becomes the business of the school division when we have to monitor all those things. And if we're going to have to monitor all those things, we want to make sure these kids are between the ages of 5 and 18 and that they live in our district. And I don't believe that that's unreasonable to ascertain as a general reading for this code section.
What happens if a parent chooses to disobey the policy, the new policy, doesn't give a birth certificate, doesn't give the required proof of residency, and just insists that the statutory requirements have been met and homeschool? What happens to them? Are they exposed to a class 4 misdemeanor crime?
Well, that would be that would meet the definition of compulsory attendance. I mean, if they're not following our policy.
So before your policy, which has been represented to us to have not been applied retroactively, before your policy, no one could be convicted of this problem. But after your policy, they can be convicted, criminally convicted.
Well, before our policy, we get a list of homeschool students or students who notice their intent to homeschool. And if there are students that we don't receive paperwork for, we don't get those documents in time in August, then the school system typically tries to investigate as to why that paperwork is not submitted to the school in the timely fashion. So in this case, let me go back. So if the parents refuse to cooperate and get their paperwork in, their notice of intent, their educational, the other things that are outlined in the statute that are required, then obviously either a CHINS petition is filed or a compulsory attendance violation on the parents are filed. So in this case, with this policy, the birth certificate and the proof of residency would be incorporated into that paperwork, as the policy says.
Is there any question in this case as to the birth dates of the children or the residency of the family? Is that factually in contest at all in this case?
With the SOSABs?
Yes.
No, Your Honor.
So the only thing that puts them at risk of a Class 4 felony is that they're not handing up to you the birth certificate and some sort of proof of residency, when the fact is you don't have any contest with that, and you know that they are, in fact, the appropriate age, and they do reside in the county.
Well, it wouldn't be a Class 4 felony. It would be a Class 4 misdemeanor, Your Honor.
Sorry, I misspoke. So let me repeat it, though, because to me it means a lot. You have no contest with the underlying facts. They meet the statutory definition for purposes of the birth dates of the children, the age of the children, and their residency. But they haven't given you some paperwork that you've demanded. And if they don't give you the paperwork you've demanded, as I understand your view of the statute, they're at risk of a Class 4 misdemeanor. Is that right?
Well, yes, Your Honor, with respect to, I mean, you have to look at this as a whole, not just the SOSABs. This is a policy that affects our entire school division, and not everyone is as forthcoming and as forthright as these particular people. There are individuals, the reason for the policy is that there are individuals that try to skirt compulsory attendance laws. And they play a game with the school system, saying, you know, okay, well, you're not in school. Well, okay, then I'm going to homeschool. If we seek legal action against a particular parent, if a child has missed, you know, 10, 15, 20 days, or is not coming to school at all, and charging the parents, they try to skirt that issue by homeschooling. And so I don't think that this request is unreasonable. I mean, the statute clearly says that people can homeschool their children between the ages of 5 and 18. I don't understand the issue with the reading of the statute, where it clearly we're trying to verify that they're between those ages as the statute outlines. That's the reason for the policy. And it's not particularly directed at the SOSABs or any individual who is not forthcoming with the school system. It's a policy where, quite frankly, you know, the school system has to manage all these things, and they want to make sure that they're managing students who live within their district.
So, counsel, in essence, are you saying the policy is not what puts the parents at risk of violating a misdemeanor? It's them not satisfying the compulsory education requirements that are put there by the General Assembly that puts them at risk of being in violation of a misdemeanor, isn't it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you repeat that question?
The policy does not put them at any greater risk of being charged with a misdemeanor for not submitting their children to compulsory education, is it?
No, Your Honor.
In fact, it's an insurance policy to make sure they're not going to be charged with that misdemeanor.
That's correct.
Because you have verification that they do satisfy the compulsory education requirements that have been put in place.
That is correct.
Okay, that's what I thought you were saying.
So let me follow up then. So in this particular instance, you don't have any question about what the facts are. The children are in the right age, and the family is in a resident of the county. But they're not going to give you the notice, let's say. They just refuse to do it because they take the position you don't have the authority to do it. If they continue to homeschool without giving you the notice, does that put them at any risk at all? And if so, what risk do they have?
Well, that's an interesting. I guess it would depend on how we know these children are between the ages of 5 and 18 and live in Franklin County. If it's just because the parents said so, I just don't think that that's going to. I don't think that meets the policy, and I think our division would seek legal action to enforce the policy. But in this case, I mean, the Sosabe swore under oath at court that they lived in Franklin County and their child was between the ages of 5 and 18. So that's where that satisfies Franklin County Public Schools as far as the Sosabes go. But I'm talking about future individuals who may – out of the blue, there's a five-year-old child. We've never seen this child before. They show up in our district, and they want to homeschool this child. And we're going to ask for a birth certificate and proof of residency. And if they can't provide that, then, you know, I believe our district would seek legal action pursuant to that policy.
What kind of legal action?
Well, it would be a compulsory attendance issue or CHINS petition, depending on the age of the child. Well, in this case, in that particular hypothetical, it'd be a five-year-old, so more than likely a compulsory attendance against the parents.
And would that put them at risk of misdemeanor exposure?
It would, Your Honor. Now, obviously, Franklin County Public Schools isn't out to put people in jail or to convict people. We just want them to comply with the policy.
It sounds to me like it's not a child in need of services. It's a school board in need of paper.
Well, we're in need of proof of age and residency.
Well, you just recited that you have that proof.
For the Sosabes, yes, Your Honor. I think the court needs to understand that there are other homeschoolers and potentially more homeschoolers in the future that the school division would have to deal with.
Well, it seems like, in other words, you're saying you're not worried about parents who go into oath and swear to these things. They're going to be fine. But what about the ones that don't? Those are the ones who will be at risk, correct?
That's correct. We even asked for a sworn affidavit at one point, just to say that the children are between the ages of 5 and 18 and they live in Franklin County. Are there any other questions with regard to that?
All right, your time has expired. Rebuttal?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I want to
counsel, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Counsel, I have a question for you. I noticed in the notice that was provided by the Sosabes, they included the age and the residence of their children. They're not required to do that, are they, by the statute?
That's correct, Your Honor. They are not.
Why did they do that? Do you have any idea?
Well, I think the Sosabes, talking with the Sosabes, this is information that they recognized could be useful to the school board to have. That's where I think the argument by the board goes off the rails. This case is not about whether or not the information requested by the board is reasonable. It's about whether the board has the authority to threaten parents with prosecution if they won't provide evidence that's not required in the statute. There's nothing wrong with parents providing additional information to the school board if they want to do so. And there's nothing wrong with the school board asking parents to provide additional information, especially as we've mentioned earlier, if the board has some reason to think that the parents are lying. That's not what the policy is doing. The policy does not say in cases where there is doubt, parents can be asked to provide a birth certificate or proof of residence. It requires all parents, when they begin homeschooling, if they haven't previously filed this paperwork with the school division under the statute of the General Assembly that requires parents who enroll their children in public school to provide this information, it requires all parents to provide this information automatically.
And the board has, how do they figure out when it's in doubt?
Your Honor, we would suggest if there's something on the face of the document that suggests there's something wrong, or if the board has some evidence to believe that the parents are misrepresenting. Again, that's not because of anything in the homeschool statute. There are other enforcement statutes that make it a crime for parents to provide false information about the age or their residency of their child. And that can ultimately lead to prosecution, but the burden is always on the state to gather the evidence to support a prosecution. It's not on the parent, in the first instance at least, to dispute that, to present negative proofs that they are in fact have children who are compulsory attendance age, that they do in fact live in the district. The SOSBs, as do most parents in the district, provide plenty of information in the notice of intent that not only that satisfies the requirement of the statute. And that's really what this is about. Can the board require parents to present more evidence than the statute requires, especially in circumstances like this, where it has no reason to doubt the evidence, the information that's been provided by the SOSB?
Your time has expired. Thank you for your argument. Call
Thank
the
you,
next
Mr.
case.
Would you hire an appellate lawyer to handle your jury trial? Of course not. Trying cases requires a different focus, a different way of speaking, even a different way of thinking from handling appeals. So why would you ask a trial lawyer to handle your appeal? When it comes time to appear in an appellate court, trust a lawyer who specializes in appeals only. Steve Emmert limits his practice to appeals. Other lawyers consult him when they face tough problems in the appellate maze. Focus on what you do best. Call Steve Emmert at 757-965-5021 direct to find out how he can help you. Again, that's Steve Emmert at 757-965-5021.